Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Gail Seiler, your host, and I'm here with Evan Taylor, who is our new engineer, just starting at KHOI. I believe this is his first Local Talk show that he's doing with us, so I want to welcome Evan and welcome him to the KHOI team. We've had some wild weather lately, which I guess is not too unusual for this time of year in Iowa. But Friday night in downtown Ames, the weather had quite an impact on an annual event called Foodies and Brew, which took place on Douglas Avenue right near KHOI's studio. This event featured chefs from local restaurants and beverage samplings from local cafes and breweries featuring beer, coffee, and tea. But if you remember, Friday afternoon, a strong storm rolled through around 2 p.m., and that was when the organizers were setting up for the event, including putting out tables and chairs and tents and a stage. Then it stopped raining, and the event started as planned at 6:30. But about 20 minutes into it, dark clouds rolled in, and with it came the winds. And it was very windy, but the vendors and attendees were undeterred. People continued eating and drinking and talking and having a great time, all while holding onto the tents to keep them from blowing away as best they could. But the weather kept getting worse and worse, and then it started raining, or rather torrents of rain started coming down. That caused many people to scurry to their cars, and the crowd thinned. But there was a core group of people who stayed. Everyone crowded under the remaining tents that were still up, and the vendors tried to keep serving food and drinks, and the remaining people had a great time until it finally ended around 9:30. Here's some of the audio to give you an idea of what it was like during the height of the storm. Ursula Rudenberg, KHOI's station manager, captured these sounds. You'll hear the wind and the rain, along with exuberant voices of people at Foodies and Brew in downtown Ames on Friday night.
Even though I'm got water running down my butt crack.
Hey, no potty talk in this tent.
Hey, I think we're having a good time. We don't think the heavy stuff's coming down for quite a while.
Are you guys having fun?
We are. There's good beer here and good food. I'm enjoying myself.
It's an experience.
I'm having a great time. Heavy rain means shorter lines for beer.
Lucky Duck, how are you doing?
A lovely English weather here.
How's business?
Well, it's a little slow now. It was good earlier, and we're continuing. And our morale is high.
Is everybody left?
Good time. There's still beer and food. So.
We got a good spot right next to a bar.
It's funny to see everybody packed under the tents.
It really sets kind of a new atmosphere.
Yeah. It's a new way of voting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're doing fantastic. Yeah.
Are you worried at all?
No.
Everything's under control?
Yep.
I still love it.
You like being an Iowan?
Every day of my life.
Everybody okay here?
Yeah.
How are you doing, Andrea?
This is my second time today getting wet. So much for the fundraiser at Main Street Cultural District.
That last voice was Andrea Granot, the organizer of Foodies and Brew, and the manager of Worldly Goods. She should get a lot of credit because she got soaked twice, once while they were setting up in the afternoon, and then again during the event. And let's give another shout out to the chefs and workers who kept trying to put out attractive plates of yummy food despite the rain and wind, and to the intrepid food lovers who would not be put off by an Iowa summer storm. It was a great time, and I can attest to that because I was one of the people enjoying it. If you were there and you saw two people wearing white garbage bags to try to keep dry, that was me and my friend Carla Peterson. Thanks for sticking with it, Carla. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Radio. The rest of our show today is going to focus on women faculty at ISU, particularly in the sciences, and we'll also focus on a building in Campus Town. That may sound like disconnected topics, so if you want to learn how they're connected, a building in Campus Town and women at ISU, stick around and listen. We're going to be talking about the Cranford Building, and to learn more about it and its historic link to women faculty, Ursula Rudenberg spoke with Marilyn Gibbs Alger, who co-owns the Cranford with her brother, Monty Gibbs. Marilyn Gibbs Alger is a resident and native of Ames. In fact, she represents the fourth generation of the Gibbs family in Ames. So let's hear what she had to tell us about the Cranford.
Cranford Building is at the corner of Lincoln Way and Stanton, across from Lake Laverne and the trees that are along Lake Laverne.
It kind of holds down that end of the block between Stanton and Welch.
Yes.
It's kind of a signature building for Campus Town.
Yes. I like to think of it as kind of a cornerstone to the historic buildings that are left in Campus Town.
Describe a little bit how the building looks. It's a red building?
Yes, red brick building. It was built in 1922. It's very stately. The first level are local businesses, Jeff's Pizza and Singer Station.
The building has four floors?
Yes. And the upper three floors are apartment buildings. There's 30 apartments. And there's also an attic level that we're just using for storage right now.
Why is the Cranford significant?
Well, the Cranford Building opened in 1922, and there were a group of Iowa State faculty women who pooled their resources. They developed a company called the Faculty Women's Housing Company. They were women who were faculty at Iowa State College at that time. I found in my research that before the Memorial Union was built, there were some veterinary buildings in that location. There was a campus hospital, and I can't remember if it was in 1927, but the buildings that were there were torn down, and then the Memorial Union was built after that. And for a short period of time, there were a group of faculty women who had meetings in what they called Cranford Hall. There was a Cranford Hall before the Cranford Building was built. So I don't know that there's a direct connection, but I think possibly those women who were meeting in what was called Cranford Hall were the faculty women that developed the Cranford Building. At the time in Ames, there was plenty of housing for students, and there was housing for married faculty. But there was not what the women considered kind of safe and adequate housing for single faculty women.
It's interesting when one thinks about the 1920s, one doesn't necessarily imagine single women faculty at Iowa State University. Can you talk a little bit about who they were and why Iowa State had enough faculty women that they actually could do something like this or feel the need?
Mm-hmm. When I first started my research, I made an assumption that maybe they were all with the home ec college. But it turns out that these were women in the sciences and math, which is interesting because today there's such a need for women in science and math. So to me, that was interesting, too, at the time that there were faculty women in math and botany in the sciences. There were faculty in the English department. As I look through the records of who has lived at the Cranford Building, you oftentimes saw a faculty member and then their secretary lived in the building as well. I also found in the early years there were seven librarians with the Iowa State Library. Many of them were Iowa State graduates. Some came from other colleges and then came to Iowa State to teach, and some of them then went on to get advanced degrees at Iowa State, master's and doctorate degrees. But these were, you know, empowered women. One was the officers at the time of the Faculty Women's Housing Company were Estelle Buchanan, and she was a professor in botany. She was married. Her husband's name was Earl, and besides teaching, they also authored some books on botany. And Buchanan Hall was named after the Buchanans. Another officer was Maria Roberts, and she was in the math department, and also later was the dean of what was called the junior college at the time. And the other officer was Julia Wench Stanton, who was in the math department, and she was also dean of women. I like people to picture what Ames was like in 1920 when women got the right to vote. And I think of that time as a very empowering time for women who were being inspired by Eleanor Roosevelt and Carrie Chapman Catt and Aunt Susan B. Anthony, you know, so empowered to have received the right to vote. So the Faculty Women's Housing Company pooled together, took out papers with the Secretary of State's office in Des Moines, and together they hired a female architect named Alda Wilson. And she was a graduate of Iowa State in civil engineering. She was also working at what was then the Iowa Highway Commission, now the Department of Transportation. About the same time, she designed the Cranford Building, and she was the first supervisor of a women's drafting department. So these women faculty hired Alda Wilson to design the building, and she oversaw the supervision of the building. So I sometimes chuckle to myself and imagine what it was like for men workmen to be receiving their direction from a female. One interesting thing that I've thought about in terms of the history of the Cranford Building was Alda Wilson, the architect. She graduated in 1894 from Iowa State College in civil engineering. Both Alda Wilson and her sister, Elmina, who was also in civil engineering, they were the first two sisters to graduate from civil engineering at Iowa State College. And 1 year, Alda Wilson and her sister, Elmina, took a year off from their work and studied abroad for a whole year, learning about European architecture. So it was kind of partly a pleasure trip, but also a study trip for a year to study architecture in Europe. At the Iowa State Archives, they have a box with information for the Wilson sisters, and they have sketchbooks on their travels where they sketched architectural details as well as descriptions of things they were seeing on their travels. So I have to think that as Alda was observing and taking this all in, that when she came back, she had, you know, she was influenced by what she saw in Europe. So I've wondered how they were influenced by European architecture. And when you asked earlier what the Cranford Building looks like, in my research, when I've looked at some of the buildings in Europe that were built at that time, to me there's a resemblance between the architecture style. As I mentioned, Alda Wilson's sister, Elmina, was also in civil engineering, and she was an architect. And Alda and Elmina had an older sister named Olive, whose husband was Charles Curtis. So Curtis Hall and campus was named after him. So one of the things I found, too, in my research is that some of these original founding women and women who worked or lived at the Cranford Building have had dormitory halls named after them. So they had a great contribution to Iowa State College at that time, and maybe in their wills gave money to the university, but had dormitories named after them.
Women have had an influence over the university pretty much from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. One other tidbit I wanted to mention that I know from my research that the Wilson sisters knew Carrie Chapman Catt, and when Ms. Catt's administrative assistant passed away in 1928, Alda Wilson became Carrie Chapman Catt's executive secretary and companion from 1928 to 1947 when Ms. Catt died.
Say a thing or two about Ms. Catt.
Well, Carrie Chapman Catt was born in Wisconsin but moved to Iowa, lived in Charles City her growing up years, and then came to Iowa State and was one of the great leaders in the women's suffrage movement. So again, I think I have this image of that 1920s feel with the work that Carrie Chapman Catt was doing and the Wilson sisters and the faculty women at Iowa State getting together and forming a community of women who were empowered and realized they could make a difference in students' lives and a contribution to Iowa.
And clearly they saw women as having needs that needed to be addressed.
Yes. So when they saw that there was not adequate housing for faculty, single faculty women in Ames, again, I can imagine those discussions of, well, we could do this. You know, we're strong women. We're bright women. We know who the movers and shakers are. And I'm not sure how they knew Alda Wilson, but through connections, they hired her as their architect.
And was this organization they formed, was this a business, a for-profit business?
Yes. They registered their paperwork with the state of Iowa, and it was called the Faculty Women's Housing Company.
And did they hire a manager to manage the building?
Well, initially, the three founding officers, Estelle Buchanan, Maria Roberts, and Julia Wench Stanton, were the initial managers of the apartment. Maria Roberts lived in the Cranford building for 20 years until her death.
So did they essentially own shares in this business and essentially split up the profits among themselves?
Yes. And the interesting thing is, you know, now our goal is to have all 30 apartments rented. And from the records that I've seen from the beginning, it appeared as though the apartments weren't always rented, and that I saw some that were Iowa State Extension people that might come in and just live there for a semester. One more sure. Well-known resident, Ada Hayden, was in the botany department, and she for many years lived on her parents' farm. And when her parents died, and over time, I think I read that she could no longer pay the taxes, and so she moved into Ames closer to campus. And so she moved into the Cranford building and lived there for about 10 years. And for those Ames residents that know of Ada Hayden Park and the work that Ada Hayden did at Iowa State in the botany department, she did lots of research on plants and just a lot of biological testing and identification of plants and prairie plants. She lived in apartment number 23.
Did they only rent to women in the building?
Initially, the intention was just to be a women's facility, and then you could see gradually over time they started renting to graduate students, and there were a few married couples that lived there. Found the record of one woman who her husband had passed away, and she was a faculty person at Iowa State and had two children there for a period of time. So it seemed as though it was started as single women, and then gradually, as it became more of a business, then they rented to male students as well.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're listening to an interview that Ursula Rudenberg, one of our Local Talk producers, did with Marilyn Gibbs Alger, the co-owner of the Cranford Building in Campustown. I found it very interesting to learn about the names of buildings and residence halls and streets at ISU and in Ames, and how they are associated with women who were at ISU in the early 1900s. I wonder if the current resident of apartment 23 knows that the prior resident was Ada Hayden. Marilyn has obviously done a great deal of research into the history of the Cranford Building and into the history of women in the early 1900s at ISU. Next, we're going to hear what the building and the apartments in the Cranford are like now.
Does a building of this age have elevators?
It has an elevator that was also part of the building built in 1922. So in 7 years, the elevator will be 100 years old. It's one of those elevators that you open the iron gate and push the buttons.
And like you see in the movies.
Uh-huh, and it slowly moves up. And last summer, I decided to repaint the elevator, the inside of the elevator, and I stenciled it. I tried to pick out stencils that might feel like the 1920s. And I put a plaque on the wall that said Cranford Apartments established 1922. So we've gotten some good feedback from residents that it's nice to have the elevator upgraded. So we knock on wood and hope that it continues to function. It's inspected periodically, so we know it's in good functioning condition. But at some point, we might have to replace it.
Does it have an elevator operator?
Just the students, yes. If I had the time, I'd love to do that.
No man in a uniform.
No. I'm not sure it ever did.
Can you describe what the apartments are like in the building?
They are smaller apartments. There are some that are efficiencies, so a one-room apartment with a little kitchenette. Some of the apartments still have Murphy beds, so the bed that goes up in the wall and comes down.
Do people use Murphy beds?
Yes. We actually had one young man who said he heard about the Murphy beds, and that's why he wanted to rent the apartment, because he'd always wanted to sleep in a Murphy bed. Some students have asked us to remove them so they, you know, have their own bed in there, but they're still available if students are interested in sleeping in a Murphy bed. And then it has a small kitchenette. Other apartments in the building are one-bedroom apartments, and some are kind of a one-and-a-half, and then there are some two-bedroom apartments.
Are these considered high-rent or low-rent apartments?
Probably median range, and certainly lower rent than the high-rise apartments with a lot of amenities. But we're a historic building. We think of our apartment building attracting a certain kind of student, maybe students who bring their bicycle to campus, or because we're so close, they walk, because we don't have parking.
When people come to rent the apartments, do you require that they're a student in order to be able to have access?
No, they could be a working person in Ames.
I see. So it's open to anybody, really?
Yes.
Is the apartment in demand?
Yes. We haven't had any problems with vacancies.
Tell us who lives in the building.
The 30 apartments are rented to mostly college students at Iowa State. We hear from students part of the reason they like it is it's so close to campus. It's right along Lincoln Way, so they can take Cyride if they want to. And, of course, it's above Jeff's Pizza, which is a nice asset for meals. I talked to a student recently, a male student, who said that he had lived in other places in campus and wanted to finish out his senior year at the Cranford building because it's quieter and so close to campus. I found out recently we have a faculty member that's living in the Cranford building, and he talked about enjoying the kind of historic nature of the building.
Okay, so over the years, who ended up owning the Cranford?
The Faculty Women's Housing Company owned the building from 1922 when it opened until 1953. Maria Roberts died in 1950, and so I think, you know, there might have been some discussions at that time that if some of the original women weren't part of it, Estelle Buchanan was still a part of the group. And so Estelle and her husband Earl became the owners of the building from 1953 until 1966. And the Buchanans had a son named Joseph, who was an attorney in Ames, and he then, from his parents, had the building from 1966 until 69. One of the offices in the Cranford building was his law office. Early businesses in the Cranford building on first floor, there have been jewelry stores, a couple pharmacies, there have been doctor's offices, there was a hair salon for a while. Clothing stores. I remember when I was growing up in Ames, Bobby Rogers was one of the women's clothing stores in Ames. So that was one of the businesses. So many businesses have been there in the years. After Joe Buchanan, there were a group of Ames businessmen who, once again, like the women, pooled their resources. This group of men, one of them, including my father, Earl Gibbs, pooled their money together. They had kind of a business investment club that they were learning from each other about investments. So in 1969, they purchased the Cranford building from Joe Buchanan. And then over the years, as the male partners passed away, their wives became partners. And so it was gradually becoming a women's ownership once again. My father, Earl Gibbs, and my mother, Mickey Gibbs, were partners in the Cranford building from 1969 to 1995 when my mother passed away. And one of the remaining partners at that time was Jean and Ruth Harris, who had Harris TV and Appliance in Ames. And Jean Harris died a little over a year ago, and so his wife, Ruth Harris, then became partner with my brother, Monty Gibbs, and myself. And after Jean's passing, Ruth just decided it was time that she wanted to kind of move out of real estate somewhat. So my brother Monty and I purchased her portion of the building in December of 2015. So now my brother and I are sole owners.
That was Marilyn Gibbs Alger talking about the Cranford building, which she co-owns with her brother. So interesting to hear her describe the elevator in the building, the old style elevator, and Murphy beds in some of the apartments. It makes me want to have a tour of the building. It sounds so intriguing. It also sounds like Miss Alger and her brother are quite welcoming and accommodating landlords, something which students don't always experience in Ames. Recently, work has been done to restore the facade of the Lincoln Way side of the building. And Marilyn tells us about that. And also, in the next segment, she talks about what it means to her to own this historic building and be a part of it now.
In 2015, the City of Ames offered a facade grant either to modernize a building or one of the aspects was to restore a historic building, and that's where we fit in. And thanks to Jeff Benson, who was with the City of Ames at the time and unfortunately passed away, he approached my brother saying, there's this facade grant that you might be interested in. When we applied for this grant, I started researching the history of the Cranford building. So all that I've shared with you today and much, much more is what I learned from doing my research about the history of the Cranford building. I think the city feels it's been a success, and so they're offering grants for 2016, and we've applied to be one of the grants to finish the Stanton side. The first year was the Lincoln Way facade, and we looked at early pictures of the building to determine we wanted to restore it back to the 1922 look that the women of the Cranford building imagined.
So the way that Cranford looks now facing Lincoln Way is the way it looked originally. It has kind of two colors.
Yeah, there's wooden panels, and we don't have colored pictures from the time. So we worked with a firm in town with John Lott to look at colors of the time. So we picked colors that we thought made the building look, you know, stately and as we imagine it did in 1922. One of the things we're doing that's not part of the facade grant, but behind the Cranford building on the Stanton side is a courtyard. And some of the things I've read about the building of the building was that there was this courtyard there from the beginning. I wish we had pictures of the original courtyard, but we're, again, trying to restore the courtyard to what we would imagine it would have looked like during those kind of Victorian times. And some of my research has looked at some things in England and buildings, and so I decided that it might be nice to have an English garden feel. We've been working on some hardscapes, and we just this week planted some trees. It'll probably be a three-year project where we'll be restoring the courtyard.
So what does this all mean to you? What does the Cranford mean to you personally? Do you like the building?
Oh, I love the building. Mm-hmm. It's much more than a building to me.
Why do you love it?
Well, my background is social work, so I've always worked with people. And so to me, people and their stories are what makes life meaningful. I feel like I've done enough research of the women of Cranford that I feel like in some ways I know them as people. And so when I think of things we're doing, I do them not only for the residents who live there to make their stay more enjoyable during their 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, however long they might choose to live there. But always I keep in the back of my mind honoring the women who started the building, and I want to make them proud.
So you see yourself as part of the tradition.
Yeah, I feel like we're the current caretakers of the Cranford building. We have no intent in selling the building. We would be very sad if someday someone tore it down and built something else. Because of what I've learned about the history, again, it's not just a building, but it's part of Iowa State's history. These were, you know, in essence, a lot of the people were the who's who of Iowa State College at the time. So I just feel a responsibility to those women in that time to respect the building, and we hope the tenants who live in our building, the residents who live there, will feel that same sense of respect for our history.
Do you feel the building has a spirit?
I do. This may sound funny to people, but even while I was researching, sometimes I'd wake up at 2 and 3 in the morning, and I almost felt sometimes like the women were tapping me on the shoulder and saying, get busy, you know, do some more research, learn more about us and our and the building that we built together. Because to me, it is an amazing story. And I think it can serve to, when I think of almost 100 years and that there are 30 apartments, how many, I haven't stopped to figure out, you know, how many people have lived in the Cranford building for almost 100 years. But I also think of the students who live there in the future. And, you know, the women who built it made a contribution to Iowa State and to Ames in the state of Iowa. But we don't know who might be living there this year, who might go on to make a great contribution to the college and to our state. And so I'm always hopeful.
And you're making a contribution. I mean, I can understand why these women were tapping you on the shoulder. Women's history generally is forgotten. I didn't know about these women.
Well, and when you think of students that live in dormitories and each dorm has a name, but to understand that that name is a person. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to research the dorm that they're living in, they could do some research at Iowa State and learn about the person who the building was named after.
Campus Town is really dramatically transforming into a high-rise section of Ames. How does it feel to be in a historic building in the middle of the part of town that's really turning into a very different type of environment?
I kind of think of the Cranford building as kind of a cornerstone, and I think of it as we're part of the past and the future. Hopefully some other buildings in Campus Town will, you know, owners will decide to keep them and restore them, but if that doesn't happen, I hope for, you know, another 100 years to come, the Cranford building will still be there and remind people of the history and what architecture looked like in 1922.
We've been listening to an interview that Ursula Rudenberg did with Marilyn Gibbs Alger. In other parts that we didn't get to hear this morning, the owner told us that she's looking for photos, particularly of the courtyard and of the interior of the building or of the apartments, to assist them in just their historical understanding, but also in terms of making it look like and actually restore it to some resemblance of what it was. So if any of our listeners have photos or other information that might add to this growing knowledge about the Cranford building, she asked that you get in touch with her. Thanks so much to Marilyn Gibbs Alger for sitting down with Ursula Rudenberg from KHOI for this wonderful conversation that we are delighted to be able to share with you today. This is Local Talk on KHOI Radio. Thanks for being with us today. We've been, up to this point in the show, taking an historic look at women faculty at ISU by learning about the Cranford building. But now we'll be switching to the current day. I've been joined in the studio by Laura Lee Crystal, who is the director of the Program for Women in Science and Engineering at ISU, also known as WISE. WISE. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And you had a little trouble finding us, but we're really glad you're here. So let's start by talking about what the goal of WISE is. Again, it stands for Women in Science and Engineering. So what's the purpose?
So the purpose of the program is to encourage girls K through 12 to think about careers in science and engineering, inspire them to choose those fields, and then at the college level to help them persist through graduation so that we can graduate more women in science and engineering majors to go out into the workforce, to graduate school, professional schools, those types of things.
So listeners might be surprised to hear that we still need a program like this, that women are still underrepresented in many areas of science and engineering and so on. But that's still true.
That's still true in some areas. So, the Program for Women in Science and Engineering was founded 30 years ago. We're actually celebrating our 30th anniversary. And so over the past 30 years, we've seen a large increase of women in the biological sciences, at least at the undergraduate level. There's some disparity when you start looking mm-hmm. more at the, faculty ranks through graduate school faculty. But at the undergraduate level, we've made a lot of progress in the biological sciences. Not that it's, all, sort of corrected, but it's really in the physical sciences, engineering, that we're still seeing the very low numbers. Colleges of engineering across the nation are between that 15% and 20% enrollment for women. Physics, chemistry programs are still a little bit lower, but again, they're getting better. Mm-hmm. But we still have some pockets like computer science that we've just lost ground since the mid 1980s, where we've actually gone from 40% down to, 10 and 20% depending on the institution.
Yeah, that's really remarkable because, you'll hear people say that, there's lots of people in biology, but there's still fields where there's a big disparity and a big gap.
Absolutely.
Okay. So what would you say in those fields where there's still, a disproportionality in terms of women, what are the main impediments or roadblocks that keep those numbers so low?
I think there's a myth out there that about ability. Today girls are graduating from high school with all of the same math that boys are graduating. The only place where you see a little bit of differences between math and science is in physics. Our girls, especially in Iowa, are maybe not taking physics at the same level, but they're graduating the same numbers of students. What's happening is girls aren't making that choice, that career choice at the college level to go into these majors. And it has if there was just a magic bullet, but there's a lot of different, reasons for it. One is just lack of role models. Girls don't grow up seeing physicists at the front of the classroom typically, in their lives, on the television, social media.
Women physicists, yes.
And so there's not individuals that necessarily look like them that are, out and visible for them to role model. So there's a lack of role models is one of them. There's also sort of, a lot of pressures for girls, not to be good at math and science. And so, it's about being accepted. And it's getting better, but we send subtle messages throughout their lifetimes about that, the fact that they don't mm-hmm. belong in these fields, that they're kind of an imposter. We see it all the time at the college level, women walking into the classroom and, somebody saying, "Are you lost?" That they're not automatically, assume that they're in the right place. And so, there's the T-shirts that you can buy that says allergic to algebra. You see it in all sorts of environments that women don't belong in these fields. And so I think that subtle message is over time, sort of takes its toll. And so when they're graduating, again, not a natural fit for them. And so the final thing that I would say is, there's a in terms of some of the gender differences, is that girls want to know what they're going to do with their, with their lives is going to impact others around them. So medicine is a great example. We've seen, enormous growth in women going into medicine. Obviously they can compete, they're doing very well, but they can see that direct connection to helping others. Veterinary medicine is another example. But in the physical sciences, especially engineering, computer science, women don't see that natural fit of how am I helping other people? How am I, helping the environment? And so if we can show how engineers, for example, are improving the human condition, improving, the world around us, the girls tend to latch onto that and they're more excited about that piece. It's not so much the financial rewards, but it's more about the good that they can do in this world. And so I think we do a really bad job of messaging science and engineering to young girls.
Okay. And students today still share stories with you within the program about things like you described, walking into a college, whatever, physics class or engineering class and being asked, are you lost?
Absolutely. Oh. I know it's really it's hard shocking. To believe, but yeah. It is. It's really shocking. Labs not wanting to be, have a partner that's a female, wanting to, make sure that they have an all-male team. And then when they are on those teams, oftentimes they end up being sort of sidelined into supportive roles. Okay, well, why don't you take notes?
Take
You've
notes.
Got better handwriting. So a lot of those traditional comments, are still happening in today's classroom, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. So how does – knowing all of this, how does WISE try to address this?
Sure. So we do a number of different we'll call them interventions, but programs for students. And, there's one part of our, office that we do programming. It's, helping support the students. And I'll talk about that. And there's another piece of it that's, improving climates for students. It's not that that the women are broken, that we need to, fix them. Mm-hmm. We really need to work on the climates that we're doing. But I'll start with a programming piece. So the at the undergraduate level, when students come in, what we do is we have something called the Women in Science Engineering Learning Communities. So it's a residentially based program for women. For men, especially in engineering, if they live on a residence hall floor, they make up 85% of the College of Engineering. When they live on a regular floor, there's going to be other engineers on that floor. So at 10 o'clock at night, when they're having a problem with calculus, they can go next door. There's going to be somebody else that's taking those courses. For women, they make up such a small percentage of the College of Engineering. When they live on a floor, just sort of a traditional floor, there's probably not going to be anybody taking calculus, much less in engineering. And so what we do is cluster these women onto residence hall floors throughout the campus. We have about 15 of those floors this year. So we have about 400 women that live together on various floors throughout the Iowa State University campus. And it works to reduce that isolation that women often feel, that they're the only ones in it, that they have a whole group. There's about 20 to 25 women on each of these teams. And they're there to support one another. And when they have a stumbling block, something comes up, they're with a whole group of individuals that get it, understand what they're going through. And, it's kind of normalizes the process of what that first year looks like. There's a lot of gateway courses that, students are presented with, calculus especially. Mm-hmm. And so they have a whole group of individuals that are able to do that. So we focus on that social piece, just building community. The second part we do is the academics. So we work to, if they're not feeling comfortable with a course, we'll provide tutoring through the Academic Success Center. There's a peer mentor piece where there's upper division students that are like big sisters on campus that will help provide that tutoring, get them access, connect them to faculty, which is the number one thing that we really mm-hmm. want the students to do. And then the other piece of it is leadership development. So building that confidence in their skills. So when they graduate, they're the very best candidates. And so we really start that in the freshman year, having them speak out, understanding that, there's team dynamics and that, they shouldn't be in a particular role. They have other roles that they can play within groups. And so just building that confidence in that first year.
And so that's all those things you've just mentioned are for students in the learning communities, or is that available more broadly to women going into these fields?
Yeah. So one of the challenges is when you do a residential program, students have to sign up before they get here. And so we try to be as proactive as we can to let students know about the program. Mm-hmm. However, there are students that can't join for whatever reason, athletes, students that maybe live off campus. So any student that walks in our office and wants to get involved, We connect them with a peer mentor and a group. It's not quite the same as living on a residence mm-hmm. hall floor, but we certainly, try to do our best to connect students into some team. And so the onus is a little bit on the student. They have to be able to you know, go and take the time to connect and participate in study groups, those types of things. But we certainly want to make sure we support every student no matter where they are. And if they didn't know about it and it's January, we'll still get them involved.
Okay. So what other kinds of activities or events do you have going on?
It's really the first four semesters that students are most at risk. If we get students in their junior year, that's really when they get some of those more experiential activities. They're really deep into their majors, so they're getting that content. They're connecting to faculty. So we continue that programming into the second year, and we really add a career component to it. So some professional development, career development pieces, but trying to get women outside of campus, so connecting with professionals in an industry. So, for example, we have Rockwell Collins here in Iowa that's been a great partner, and so we're able to take groups of women over to Rockwell Collins so they can talk to professional engineers and scientists about what they do for, you know, a living, talking about how they actually apply that physics course that you're struggling through, those types of things. But they actually get to see real women in these fields beyond graduation, and that's worked out really, really nicely. And so we do a lot of other programs that are related to, you know, having students understand things like the imposter syndrome, that it's natural that they feel this way, that it's not just them, it's something that everybody goes through. It's mm-hmm. just that women are a little bit more at risk of falling into that trap. And so so we do a lot of seminars and programs around, you know, some of those issues that women have, that confidence gap that women often have. And so just by educating them about it and that this is sort of a natural process, the students, it kind of reinvigorates them that mm-hmm. they know that they can do it.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like you do a lot of work with undergrads throughout their years. Do you also work with graduate students, and do you outreach downward into the younger grades?
So we do not do – when the program was first founded, the intent was graduate students. We're also part of, you know, our program's efforts. But unfortunately, as you know, the university has grown, we just don't have the resources mm-hmm. in order to support those individuals. And there's some really great programs for graduate students
at the
university. And so we really have some graduate students that get involved in terms of giving back. And mm-hmm. so they'll come and be role models, interact with our students. But primarily, there's some other programs, you know, that we're able to direct individuals to. Iowa State has an advanced grant.
Right.
And that is really more for female faculty, and they have some programming for graduate students. We really spend about half of our time is actually spent on the K-12. And so really trying to encourage kids in general. I mean, boys and girls need to know more about STEM. But we have a program called the Student Role Model Program, where we send our undergraduate students into classrooms all over the state of Iowa to do hands-on activities with kids. And it's really important for young boys to see what a scientist and engineer looks like today. And so it really helps, you know, young boys, but also those girls to have those role models. And so that's really kind of designed more for the K-7 mm-hmm. Age group. And so those hands-on activities are free to teachers. So you can, you know, look at our website, www.wise.iastate.edu.
We'll put a link to it.
Okay. And look at the Student Role Model Program. And we do after-school programs. We do Girl Scouts. But they can come in into, you know, whatever environment is, you know, that you want, and do science activities with the kids. And there's about 100 of them. They'll map back to the state science standards. So, you know, individuals can search and find those activities. We reach about 10,000 kids in the state of Iowa mm-hmm. Each year through that Student Role Model Program. And it's also wonderful for undergraduates because it gives them some job opportunities. It's actually a paid position. They've all gone through background checks, so it's a very safe program. The other thing that we do is we bring girls from across the state onto the Iowa State University campus. So that's for grade 8 through 10. And the idea is called Taking the Road Less Traveled. And the students come onto campus with their teachers or a parent, and they go to sessions with professionals in these fields, and they do hands-on activities. And there's a lot of messaging about, you know, taking math and science in high school, mm-hmm. Making those career, you know, taking those career choices, places that they can, you know, learn more about STEM fields. But really that whole day is about seeing what opportunities are out there. A lot of times students just don't know what the opportunities opportunities are. And so we've had that program going on since 1986. It was one of our founding programs. We've had over 65,000 girls come through the Taking the Road Less Traveled Career Conference. So we're pretty proud of that right now. And then at the high school, we have some programs where students can come onto campus and actually shadow some of our undergraduate students. So again, that role modeling piece. So while they're making those decisions about what to major in, and so that's much smaller and very targeted in those very underrepresented fields. So engineering and physics and computer science.
Okay. If you look at, you know, the literature and the research done in this area, it often talks about how gender is often interconnected with other aspects of people's identities, whether it's their sexual orientation or their race. Is this something that you try to address or you discuss with the young people that you serve? Or
We don't do a lot of education with that at the K through 12 level. It is something that we partner very strongly with at Iowa State. So each, college has a multicultural liaison officer.
Right.
And so what we try to do is work together with the different colleges. So one thing about our program is that we serve 50 different majors. So four colleges, we report to the provost's office. And so what we do is partner. We've partnered very closely with the College of Engineering with their multicultural liaison officer because there is this intersection of identities. So students come in and do they have to pick the program that's, serving? Maybe they're a student of color. And so do I need to pick that program or can I pick WISE? And so what we try to do is have it work out so that students can have the best of both worlds. And so we do some joint programming together and try to make it, so that we're supporting all students. And so, but it's a matter of partnerships. Oftentimes, in some, populations, especially our LGBT students, it's really case by case and trying to figure out what is going to support that individual best. But it is something that we have on the forefront. There, oftentimes with students of color and females, it's called the double bind where, they have two things that are kind of working against them. And so whatever we can do to support those individuals. So again, we try to work with the experts in that field and deliver programming. We'll do, I guess, whatever kinds of programs those individuals need within the colleges and trying to bring students together. The other piece of that is also making sure that we're role modeling. So our student leaders are very diverse. Mm-hmm. And so trying to make sure that there are, visible minorities that are at the front of every room and so that students feel like they can see themselves in those leaders.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking with us. It's interesting hearing this after hearing the story about the women who came together to build the Cranford Building back in the 1920s to kind of find that women are still finding that purpose in coming together and supporting each other and that we have such a wonderful program at ISU to do that.
Well, thank you very much.
So thank you for sharing it with us. And like I said, we will have the link to WISE's website so people, particularly students, but other people too, can go there and learn more about it. We've been talking with Laura Lee Crystal, the director of WISE, Women in Science and Engineering Program at ISU. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Thanks to both our guests, Laura Lee Crystal, who's was just here with us, and Marilyn Gibbs Alger for her pre-recorded interview on the early history of women at ISU. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find contact information and links for the people and places we talked about today. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. You can become a member or donate at any time, and you can do that on our website, khoifm.org. Just look for the donate button. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer producers and reporters. Contact us at 292-2878. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.